What up? I'm Rock Harper. You're now listening to the Chef Rock Experiment, the podcast. Your journey to entertainment, empowerment, and education in the food business begins right now. Let's go. Okay, Zella Palmer, welcome to the Chef Rock Experiment. How are you today?
Hi, Rock. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I am well. Thank you for being here. I know you're on the move and doing some great things. Well, let me not say I know. I see on Instagram.
Thank you.
You're busy. So you've done so much and you're doing a lot. Can you sort of talk about how'd you get into the work that you're doing right now?
Well, currently I am the director and chair of the Dillard University Ray Charles Program in African American Material Culture in New Orleans. Before that, how I got involved in food ways and culture, really from my parents. My mother is a former politician and a professor. And my father, he would say he was a collector of people. He worked a lot with, leaders all over the world, worked a lot with the United Nations when Kofi Annan was Secretary General. And so that allowed me to travel a lot and see a lot of the world. And sometimes the world was actually in our home. We had people sometimes living from all over the world in our house. We had a big house on the south side of Chicago, and it was known for being a place where people could think and talk and meet. And we had artists, activists, exiles, all type of people living in the house. So it was a unique home to grow up in. And my parents, I would consider them foodies. My mother always cooked and my grandmother cooked and, the women in our neighborhood cooked. But, we also ate out a lot. So, and my parents loved to expose me to food from everywhere. Mm-hmm. But then he also saw at the same time, like many people in the 90s, in African-American neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods, because, Chicago is both, that our neighborhoods were changing and the crack epidemic was happening. Right. And I can remember my grandmother, her protesting, because they closed the grocery store in our neighborhood. Mm. And all of these little old women protesting that they were closing a neighborhood, and things started to change in our neighborhood. No longer did you see a lot of the mom and pop restaurants. I mean, you got to think about, Chicago at the time, it was, the descendants and children of people who migrated from the South, and we had restaurants like Isola's and Army and Lou's. I mean, it still is Army and Lou's and all these Gladys's and all these great soul food restaurants. And then all of a sudden it turns into, fried fish joints where you can get fish, from a bulletproof window, So to see that juxtaposition, sometimes hard because, these are my friends that I'm growing up with, and I'm buying from them, hanging with them. And then, sometimes my parents would take me to travel and then I'd see something else completely different, So it really put my perspective on what food is and what it can be for a people. Yeah. And grad school has really, really hit me that I wanted to enter into, food studies. And that was really a pivotal moment for me. I was living in Canada. I went to University of Toronto. And, although the Food Network had just come out and, I just saw also in Canada that their system, their food systems, I felt was a lot more just than the food systems that we had back home, you know.
A lot more just, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, just, and I mean, you know, some Canadians might disagree with me in that, but I can remember my daughter, when we moved there, you know, she was, she ordered a cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. And she said she wanted American cheese on it. And someone said, well, why would you want processed cheese? And it never, you know, clicked in our heads. You know what I mean? And, you know, but for that, for them to ask, you know, an impressionable teenager, you know, preteen that was just, whoa, you know. And then, you know, it opened up to a new world for me. And then just seeing how their food systems were and how they were actively talking about, you know, access to, you know, sustainable agriculture and all of these issues that Canada was facing made me wonder more. It made me wonder how we can improve our systems back home, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and especially for our communities. So when I returned, you know, I was an intern at Southern Food and Beverage Museum for quite some time.
When you returned from Toronto?
Yes. Okay. I was an intern at Southern Food and Beverage Museum for quite some time. And I worked as, you know, did a lot of work under Liz Williams. Liz Williams was the director that just stepped down. She was a mentor for me, a huge mentor. And then I did a lot of, you know, cultural work, preservation work. I was also the associate curator for the DuSable Museum of African American History in Chicago.
Okay.
And my life's passion and work has been in cultural preservation and food sustainability and food studies. So more of my work has been interdisciplinary and really encompasses what I think our culture and what we have to offer should be. And
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to tell you.
No. I said what our culture is and what it could be.
Yeah. That's a very colorful life, and that was like how old were you when you were at the museum? That's not even half of it. It seems like.
Oh, was it so many chapters? That you know, yeah. It's so many chapters. I can't remember how old I was, but I mean, I was a young professional. You know, mm-hmm. I still consider myself kind of young.
That's right. How did you get to this? That museum was the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in Chicago?
No, Southern Food and Beverage Museum is in New Orleans. So I went back and forth. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
So I worked at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and then I also worked at the DuSable Museum, where I've received a position as curator at the DuSable Museum of African American History in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back. And I'm now the head of the, you know, the Ray Charles Program in African American Material Culture at Dillard.
Yeah, I find interesting about many of the people I speak to in life, not on the show, but is how travel can just change everything, and not necessarily you going to. I mean, that's not the only way to travel.
Mm-hmm.
But imaginative travel is one thing as well. But also when you spoke about, you know, your home, growing up with your parents, you know, your father being a collector of people. I love that. And activists and artists and exiles being in your home. So this is travel coming to you. So these shared experiences, how they can really transform our past, because I don't know what it did for you. I guess that's the question. What did that do for you? Because I'm imagining that you've seen over the years where people become locked in, whether it be a neighborhood and they don't, or a mindset, and you can see the sort of the flip of not going anywhere outside of whatever your zone is. So, you know, it sounds like it was normal when you were a child.
It was normal, but it was also, I still couldn't understand as a child, you know, what my parents, because here we are in the middle of the hood, you know, and here my parents are, you know, having you know, ambassadors and all these people come to the house, you know. And I remember a funny story of my dad. He invited guests from Switzerland to the house, and they came up in their tour bus. And, you know, of course, it could imagine, you know, this is South Side of Chicago, any, you know, like every other hood in the United States. And then coming up, you know, getting off the bus and, oh, this is wonderful. And, you know, and and the neighbors just looking like, what is going on?
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, but they just got used to it. You know, they will call it the crazy house, the crazy Palmer house. That's what it
was. Yeah. That is what's up. You come stepping off the bus with the cameras around the neck and what is going on here? And sometimes, you know, you in the hood, you on the streets, you like, we can't even get mad at that.
That's my dad, you know, and that's my mother. And, you know, I'm so that they grounded me and, you know, just really also pushing me to understand African-American culture and our heritage and where we are in this world. You know, on my mother's side of the family, her grandfather was Dr. Joseph Wirtz. He was, you know, worked at Tuskegee University. He ran the first Black Veterans Hospital, you know, after World War I. And, you know, my grandmother remembers sitting on George Washington Carver's lap, you know. Just a lot of these stories that was told to me and passed down. And then on my dad's side, you know, they from New Orleans and they, you know, were enslaved. And my uncle, before he passed, you know, shared with me some research that he did of one great, great grandmother who was sold when she was 14 years old from Virginia to New Orleans. And she was a cook. Mm-hmm. You know, she was listed as a cook in the 1890 New Orleans census. So, you know, nothing is, I believe what New Orleans artist B. Mike says, that we are our ancestors' wildest dreams, you know. And I do believe that we're here to complete whatever our ancestors couldn't, you know. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm in the space that I am and in the profession that I am is a large part of, you know, just all those who came before me who got the big picture, you know. And it's an honor just to, you know, help students and get them to see that, you know, sometimes non-traditional careers, are pursuable.
Right.
In the creative world, and that you can find work in your culture.
Can you give an example of that? Like, what do you mean?
Sure. Like, for example, we could just go with Ray Charles, you know, this man, you know, or we could go to Nipsey, you know what I mean? Right. We could go from Ray Charles to Nipsey, you know.
That's a hell of a transition right there. But that is,
yeah. But I mean, they own their music.
Yeah,
you know, they owned and they gave back to their community, and they found a way to create, you know, a blueprint on how you can give back and still have a paycheck and be your own boss. Mm-hmm. You know. And so when you look at, you know, we push students, you know, there's so many fields that we have students, you know, pursue in medicine and science and, you know, film, et cetera. But, you know, there's also other careers out there that perhaps will not require, you know, standardized tests or things of that nature. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
They create on their own, right? Yeah. You know, whether it's a fashion photographer or, you know, a personal chef to the stars, you know, or a food journalist, a food photographer. I mean, there's so much. Or a stylist. I mean, we just had a food stylist, you know, visit, and that was Chef L, you know. Mm-hmm. There's not too many of us in those fields. So how do we open up and how do we let the next generation know that these positions are possible and you can create these positions, your dream job,
So you're obviously a, you're in favor of higher education, I would
take absolutely.
It seems
I'm a huge supporter of HBCUs because that, you know, from my my family, like I said, with higher education in general, but definitely I, you know, support HBCUs. The legacy of my great grandfather.
Has the approach to education changed in the past, I guess, 20, 25 years? As a lot of youngins, especially, I don't even say youngins, youth, you know, I'm speaking like I'm from where I'm from, but a lot of young people in the generation now in the culinary world seem to think that you can skip certain parts of, like, I don't need culinary school. I don't need the education at culinary school. There's a distinction there. I don't need the education because, or the 10 years that it takes to put in. And I believe that some of that is true in the sense that you might not need the way, you know, a culinary school gives it to you. I'm sorry, you do need the way, you know, the education part of it, but you might not need it in the old traditional, in the ways that we've seen new sort of leaps into learning and, you know, creating success or sort of curating your own educational experience out in the world somehow. I think many people think that you can just go do it and it'll happen, which is a mistake. But the question there is, do you think any of that has shifted, you know, in the past 20, 30 years, how education, higher education institutions look now as opposed to, you know, their importance of prior? I feel like there's not a lot of weight for a lot of people. People feel like they don't need to go to college. And I said a lot there.
Well, you know, I mean, some people might feel like that, but the statistics, you know, they don't reflect that, you know, and especially, you know, with my focus and my and what we do, you know, it's proven that African Americans who go to college have a better chance at life and earning a salary and being part of the middle class or upper middle class or beyond that. So, you know, to argue for us, you know, it's probably not a good idea to skip college or trade school. Unless, you know, there's other circumstances that will, you know, support a young person's success. But, you know, education is timeless and it's something that cannot be taken away, you know. And education is more than just a diploma. It's what you make it while you are there. And if you are, you know, a go-getter like any other young person out there, you know, your network, building your network, those internships, the opportunities, scholarships, the travel and study abroad, all of those opportunities matter, you know? And that is really what just you on your own cannot sometimes bring. And I think you have a better opportunity, a better chance to be successful if you're part of a community and, you know, universities that have been around for hundreds of years that are proven to be successful and to help young people be successful. You understand?
I'm with it. I you know, I agree with you. I think it's not the only way. That might not be popular. It's not the only way, but I think that what it is, I see a lot of people, you know, compare themselves, or they use celebrity, or they use people's highlights reels as their like measure, like they can do it because of what he or she showed me on social media. And I think that part is a huge mistake because
I agree with you. I agree with you because some, you know, social media is, you know, kind of sometimes this, you know, false reality, and sometimes you don't get to see, you know, behind the scenes. And if you don't have skills, business skills, or you don't have finance skills, you're not going to know how to run any type of business.
Right.
You know,
right.
You can't balance a budget if you don't know anything. And you know, one of the reasons why we launched a continuing education course. And you know, universities out there that are really pushing to, you know, be part of the 21st century and be more accessible to students and, you know, bring in technology and just listen to the community is, I think, applaudable, you know. I'm sorry, not applaudable. I think is, you know, a good step towards the future, you know, because young people do want, you know, a la carte, you know, and especially in this technology world that we live in today. But we launched a restaurant and catering management program, you know, a continuing education program that really is helpful for adults, you know, who are from the beginning, you know, they're just starting up, they're opening up their restaurant, they have a food truck, they're not sure what to do, to those that have been in business for 25 years and right. just need to figure out, you know, how do I maintain this restaurant, not just maintain it, but take it into the 21st century, you know, and bring support our restaurant, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and one of the key things that we found out was that, you know, what is lacking was business skills, finance skills, you know, access to understanding of loans, understanding of, you know, grants, anything that's out there that can really help their business be successful, you know, licensing, et cetera. And if you don't have those, then you're working twice as harder than you should be, you know, and that is where universities or culinary schools can be helpful, you know, to the community.
Now, can you talk about the connection between history and just why food is so important for our history? Like, how you can't separate the two. Those are my words, but it seems like they're inseparable. They follow a certain path, if you will, and the food really is a big part of that. And it, you know, your work is in cultural and food preservation. Can you talk about how you got to tell one? That's a question. Can you tell one without the other?
What do you mean? Can I tell one without the other?
Hello.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. What you said, one without the other? I missed the last part.
I'm sorry. Let me do that again. So your work is in, I'm sorry, I just had a little, we're going to edit that out. Technical difficulties on my end. We're back.
No worries. No worries. I got you.
Recorded audio. I was freaking out for a second there. Okay.
No, you're good.
Got you. So you're in the, you know, you're preserving the legacy of African American, Native American, and Latino culinary history in New Orleans and the South. And it seems to me that you can't tell the story. It's hard to separate really the history, just in general, history of any people, I think, without the food, you know, being involved, or the culinary heritage and history. You know, you can't separate those two stories. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And okay. I think it's also, you know, it's refreshing that today that more, you know, stories are coming out and people are really starting to focus on food studies and food stories for the first time in our history. You know, it's always been kind of at the background. But, you know, when I think about just people of color across the globe, food is just such an important, and it's so integral to everything, to weddings, to death, you know, to celebrations, to my, you know, that first meal after a hard day of work, you know, and, you know, just human beings in general.
Yeah.
You know, human beings in general. And, you know, it's such a rich culture, you know, that I think we need to explore more. And I'm excited, you know, that Spelman has, you know, has a food studies major, We are launching our food studies minor very soon, which I'm super excited about.
Wow, you know, congratulations.
Thank you. And to be in New Orleans, you know, the culinary capital, what I consider the culinary capital of the U.S.
Uh-oh. Watch out now.
That's a sight word. But, you know, New Orleans, you know, has a unique culture. I'll put it that way. It has a unique food culture that not just New Orleans, Louisiana in general, you know, food culture is the embodiment of so many different people that birthed this amazing cuisine and, you know, just the culture that came from it. And it's still being Creolized, you know, in the 21st century. And, you know, there's new dishes being added every day that somebody came up with, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, gumbo is changing all the time. When I look at recipes, you know, in 19th century cookbooks or, you know, in the archives for recipes for gumbo, you know, and then I look at how people make gumbo now, you know, depending on what parish you live in or what part of New Orleans or what part of Louisiana you live in, you know, it's always evolving. And people just putting, you know, I appreciate cultures that put a lot of love and time and into what they prepare. And it also reflects on, you know, this push for more slow food, you know, and more human, you know, humane food ways. I think, you know, a lot of human beings are pushing back this idea of fast food, or even if we do have fast food, what kind of fast food are we going to serve? Mm-hmm. Or what kind of fast food are we going to eat? You know, and just there's so much of, you know, richness that's out there, and so many scholars and books that are coming out. It's just amazing to see from where it was, mm-hmm. you know, to where we're headed. And I know that the next generation will not have to feel like they're in this kind of like silo and it's only 10 of us,
right.
you know,
right.
Which is good. And I'm grateful for those pioneers that came before us who, you know, made us realize that food is important. You know, how we break bread is important.
How we break bread is important. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors, and we'll come back and hear more from Zella Palmer. So that was, I just inserted that and I'll cut that out and we'll come right back right now. And I want you.
Okay, good. Let me just swallow this water right quick.
Please.
And if I said it, look, and if it edit out any words that I've, you know, got tongue-tied on.
No, you're good. We're just having a conversation on tape. That's it.
Okay, because I said something audible. I don't know what I said. I'm like, what the heck did I just say?
Yeah, I'm brilliant. Yeah. I let him know. We are human.
Look, I just got back from Cuba, so my English is the first time I'm speaking English in a while.
Now, what the Cubans speak, what is
Spanish,
it?
Spanish.
It's just Spanish, Spanish. Okay, all right.
Mm. Whenever you're ready.
Okay.
Okay, let me just eat through this ice. Hold on.
All right.
I'm good.
You good to go?
Yep, good to go.
Okay. All right, welcome back. Talking to Zella Palmer, Chair and Director of Dillard University Ray Charles Program in African American Material Culture. Zella, you said it is important. Can you repeat that? It's important how we break bread. Is that correct?
Right, correct. You know, it's just fascinating to see how each culture breaks bread. It's important that we continue this history, this of humanity, you know, to break bread with each other, to stop and take the time to, you know, put the effort, the love and the compassion into preparing a meal, you know, for other human beings. I think there's nothing more intimate than that, and inviting people and sitting down to the table and breaking bread with each other.
I would terribly agree with that, especially those that we disagree with or we don't necessarily see eye to eye on. I don't know if we ever, I feel like, you know, I'm not, the sky ain't falling on me, but we're in a different place as far as, you know, when somebody goes in other ways, like, you know, we in the cancer culture right now. Somebody tell you they like, you know, two patties and you like one, and you're like, you're canceled. You know, it's like, hold up, it's just a patty. We're, you know, we can disagree. And food is one of those things, a meal, whether it be preparation or sharing, like you said, breaking bread. It's one of those things that, it just, I don't know if there's even the act of preparing something with our hands as a chef, and then it goes into someone's mouth.
Absolutely.
For nourishment and sustenance, like that is never lost on me at the end of the day. How quick you make it, that is a very personal, and like you said, intimate experience. And my hope, my desire is that we don't forget that, and we use food as an opportunity to, you know, come together, at least, you know, over that plate, and where the conversation or we go afterward is another thing, but we can't forget that.
But my hope and desire is also that we include young people, you know, into this tradition of breaking bread, because I'll tell you, you know, it can be heartbreaking sometimes when some students who come from certain areas, you know, the only thing they've seen is a bulletproof window and snacks, you know? Mm. So, and for them, this is food, you know? So how do you introduce, you know, the culture that we've had for hundreds of years, you know? And I mean, you even think even about slavery, you know, and just when we got out of slavery, you know, the meals that we created, you know, and now looking at this generation of young people, you know, what is going to happen, you know, when hopefully things are moving towards a place where we're cooking more, right, and we're breaking bread more with each other, and we're conscious of what we're eating and what we're growing, and we'll grow more food, you know, all of those, you know, wishes that we have as a community that has always been part of our culture and traditions. I would love to see more young people into the mix. And, you know, we recently had a dining etiquette course, workshop, which was phenomenal. And, you know, we're going to do that probably every year. But we took students, you know, to a local restaurant, you know, and thank you, Coquette Restaurant in New Orleans, for hosting us. But we, you know, took them out of maybe something that they weren't used to going to, and brought them to, you know, an environment where they had to sit, you know, posture straight up, all of that. I mean, and, you know, I mean, it was an experience for them. And, you know, they said, I think I'm turning into a foodie. And but it was great, you know, and just, and it wasn't even about, you know, just, you know, the etiquette part of it. It was just the fact that we were able to sit and talk and share ideas and, you know, get to know each other. That's, I think that's the most important part about it, and have something warm go in your tummy that tastes good.
Yeah. How do you, so I went to, we met at, in New Orleans with, when you, Howard Conyers, Adrian Miller were sort of a, Howard was the host, Dr. Howard Conyers, the host, Gumbo Jubilee, Old Cow Barbecue. And we had a weekend. It was a beautiful weekend. And I've talked about it on other shows and many other people. Obviously, I've spoken about it. But that was my first time. I'd been to New Orleans before. Mm-hmm. But that was my first time, like, in the, you know, in the city.
Sure. And
I got to explore a little bit, just a bit. I didn't get, you know, and So it's just so colorful and so rich, and you can just feel, I could just feel the vibration of just so much there. I felt at home. I felt alive. And so I used to cook at a place, and we call ourselves Creole Cajun, right? And it was, the chef was, the chef originally trained under Paul Proudhon. His name was, I forget his name, but so he trained under Paul Proudhon, brought this cuisine to DC. And then I trained under, like, two chefs removed him. I didn't work for him. But we had Creole Cajun. I didn't really know much about other than what I read in books, which is really rich, right? But I, you know, I'm curious about this because I know several restaurants. Can you hear me? Hello?
Okay. Okay. You're there now.
Okay. there are several restaurants around this country, probably around this world, that say they're Creole, Cajun, even mm-hmm. Southern, right? And the question I have for you is, how does a chef, restaurateur, a concept development person appropriately open a restaurant that is not their, the cuisine that they grew up on, right? Because there's a lot of talk about cultural appropriation, you know, in DC here, right. I'm on the trail, you know, I'm not calling out everybody, but I think there's a way to do it, right? Nobody has a lock and says you can't cook anything. So right. I am curious, because a lot of people, I know this one person that came down to New Orleans on vacation, spent a few days down there, opened up, literally, and this is the story in the book. I opened up a restaurant after vacation, and I think that's beautiful in a certain sense. Like, wow, it moved me. But there was no R&D, there was no, and I went to the restaurant and it was good, but it was right. obvious. You just, the idea of what you think New Orleans is, you put on the menu. Anyway, so that's not necessarily maybe it is a criticism, but how do you do it properly? I think in a way that honors the food and tradition in your eyes.
Well, you know, the way you do it properly is understanding first the definition between Creole and Cajun.
Yes.
That's first and foremost. And then understanding Louisiana history, you know, because, you know, Chef Paul Prudhomme, he brought Cajun cuisine to New Orleans in the 80s. And, you know, he became a celebrity. And I mean, before that, there was Justin Wilson, you know. And, you know, Cajun cuisine all of a sudden became commercialized. And then you saw Cajun food all over, you know, and McDonald's and black in this and black in that. And, you know, and that happens sometimes, right? You know, a city that is popular for a certain type of dish or whatever is sometimes taken. And all of a sudden you see, you know, New York pizza in Miami. You know what I mean? Right. So, you know, that happens. But, you know, if a chef really wants to be authentic, the first thing they need to do is understand the difference between Creole and Cajun cuisine. And there is a difference.
I think that is awesome that you said that. Would you mind giving us the,
Sure. You know, I mean, we just have to, you know, go back in history and understand, you know, who was here and who contributed, you know, at what time periods, you know, Native Americans and, you know, enslaved Africans as well as Europeans, you know, they, you know, created this specifically, the ones who were doing the cooking, the majority of the cooking were enslaved Africans. Let's be honest about that,
right.
First and foremost. So Creole cuisine or Creole, you know, culture, et cetera, became a mixture of, you know, cultures, specifically African, because they were the ones who were doing the cooking and the labor mostly. And never forgetting the Native Americans, the home of the Choctaws, all of those indigenous tribes to Louisiana who contributed more than just, you know, sassafras or filet as we know it. And then, of course, you know, Europeans, specifically, you know, from France and Spain. And, you know, and French Canadians, I can't leave out French Canadians because the city was founded by Bienville. But, you know, when you think about Louisiana, enslaved Africans were not only in New Orleans, which is a cosmopolitan city, they were also in Southwest Louisiana, in what is known as, you know, the whole totality of Creole country. So when you think of Creole cuisine, there was New Orleans Creole cuisine that was close to the port, that had access to all types of seafood and was a cosmopolitan city that had all types of international people coming in and out, right? And they were creating dishes and they had restaurants with mostly black labor. And then you also had Southwest Louisiana, which, you know, was more farm and rural, that created their own Creole cuisine. Now, fast forward, the Acadians, or the Cajuns, which we eventually became, they came and mostly settled, you know, in what is considered Creole country, but is now called Cajun country.
Okay.
So Creole cuisine is also New Orleans cuisine, but is also Creole country cuisine, which morphed into Cajun cuisine, if you get my drift.
Well, so is Cajun Creole?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because if, just think about it. I mean, let's just put this in perspective. Who was here? Who was here before, you know, Acadians came? There was already a thriving society. There was already enslaved people here who were doing the majority of the cooking.
Right.
And I go back to Dr. Ibrahim Seck's book, Buki Fayette Gumbo, where he discussed, you know, if you travel to Nova Scotia, where Acadians came from, their cuisine is nothing similar. It has no similarity to, the Cajun cuisine that you have today. When Acadians came and settled, they had to live off the land and learn how to cook and prepare food like that was already in existence, and someone had to teach them that.
Right.
You know, and of course they made it their own, and they have their own nuances that makes Cajun cuisine, you know, special. But it's a very blurred line. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. It doesn't I'm sorry.
No. But I just want to make it clear that, you know, Creole cuisine is so broad. I mean, you know, here you have Creole country cooking, and here you have Creole, New Orleans Creole cuisine. I mean, just think about that, that those enslaved and formerly enslaved and free people of color, gens de color libre, they made two diverse cuisines to represent rural and urban areas.
Yeah.
From the Boudin, to, you know, d'eau glacée, you know, that's a cala, you know, all of these dishes were made in this beautiful state.
Mm-hmm. And it's bigger than reducing either Creole or Cajun to, you know, a seasoning.
Absolutely. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, because people don't understand the history of Creole cuisine, they'll put a label of Cajun on it and thinking Cajun is Creole when it's not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are Creole people who live in Southwest Louisiana, and there are Cajun people who lived in Southwest Louisiana. And there are Cajun folks who have moved to New Orleans. You know, Paul Boudin was, you know, one of those chefs that brought Cajun food to the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, our people, the African Americans, or people of African descent who are part of Creole culture, understand that Creole cuisine was the first, you know.
Right.
It was the first.
Mm. Mm. You know what brings it home for me is when I'm typing a menu and I might type Cajun or Creole, the computers make you capitalize it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a reminder. It's always a reminder that this is not just a descriptor. It might be a descriptor to most people around here.
Right.
But the capitalization reminds me that this is a people. And
absolutely.
It's a lot more than just slapping something. So make sure you're correct. Like, absolutely. Whatever you put, make sure it's true. Because if you sub out Creole or Cajun for, you know, I don't even say Italian, because that's, you know, people abuse that as well. But if you sub it out for a specific type of people, and you just think there's history behind this, and, you know, the capitalization always brings me back to, you know, is this appropriate for whatever's about to come, you know, come behind this? And you really gave me some more layers to think about. But I think the important thing is to ask. You know, a lot of restaurateurs simply, Jessica B. Harris said this in Smithsonian a couple years ago, just ask. Just like you just told me, I don't think it's that hard to call or write and ask, you know, what's in line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's sometimes heartbreaking when people come to New Orleans and say, oh, you know, I want some Cajun food. You're like, huh?
Right.
You know, and I mean, it's here. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's here, but it migrated here much later, you know.
Right. I see.
And there's two types of Creole cuisine. Like I said, there's New Orleans Creole cuisine, and then there's Southwest Louisiana Creole cuisine, you know? And I mean, when you think about it, you know, Creole has had so many different definitions, you know, it's one of those labels that has changed with time. You know, one time Creole meant everyone who's from Louisiana who was born here, you know, that included white, black, Native American, you know, and then, you know, after the Louisiana Purchase, it became black.
Right.
You know, a person of color, you know, people who had any African descent. Then, you know, later, you know, it was kind of like pushed aside, you know, and then because of commercialization, and like I said, you know, the push for the celebrity chef, you know, with Justin Wilson and Paul Prudhomme, you know, getting a spotlight, you know, then Cajun cuisine became, you know, more popular than Creole cuisine. But then, you know, here you have Miss Leah Chase, who is the queen of Creole cuisine, you know, and also not just that, but, you know, a historian who's seen it all, you know, and she really is the one who reminds people, you know, the importance of Creole cuisine and culture and their indelible mark on not only this city, but the state and the world.
Can I just tell you, you mentioned my man, and a lot of people, I've said this before, but I got into cooking because of Justin Wilson, Martin Yen too, but on PBS, Justin Wilson, I guarantee that was my guy. Like that, I was, when I saw him on TV, I was like, okay, I want to do that. You know,
my grandmother loved Justin Wilson too. You could tell her nothing about Justin Wilson.
That was my guy. So good to hear you shout his name out. You talked about, we were talking about different career paths, and you talking about ownership with Ray Charles and Nipsey Hussle, who just recently was his life was taken from a week or so ago, maybe not even.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace
to his family. And the city of Los Angeles, I can't imagine what they're going through. And the whole, I saw someone post, you know, some on Uptown New Orleans, they were, you know, taking floating balloons, you know, in honor of him. And I mean, his music was powerful. And, you know, I've been a fan for quite some time, you know, and just, you know, amazed at the work that he did for his community and the blueprint that he, you know, the model that he, you know, created, because, you know, a lot of times people leave the community and then they don't invest in the community, but he did something phenomenal, you know, and that is to be applauded.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What do you think is the biggest takeaway from Nip? Like, his music, obviously people are coming, this is their first time to him, you know, when he dies, it's their first time hearing music, which is, it's all good. But what he was doing on a community level, on a you know, economic level, is also gaining more attention now. So what do you think, what's your message? Like when people approach Nipsey's music or his work, what do you think the biggest takeaway should be, or what should they focus on first?
Who he was as a man. You know, he was a Renaissance man. You know, music was definitely a passion, but he had many passions, you know. And I think, you know, more is coming out about the work that he's done, you know, to really build the community. And, you know, I mean, that he, you know, had this clothing line. I mean, he had all types of businesses. I mean, it was more than just the clothing line. He had invested into people and, you know, created a whole network of, you know, entrepreneurs and a place where, you know, in an impoverished area where there was no, you know, access to computers and, you know, a spot where entrepreneurs could come and sit in a tech hub place. You know, I mean, it's so much that he did mm-hmm. that I think will resonate with a lot of people, you know, and there's definitely a shift happening, I think. And I think it's good, you know, where people, because for so long, you know, a lot of people have been taught to just be employees, and that's great, you know, but sometimes our parents or the generation or grandparents didn't teach us that we could also own our own businesses, you know? And so when you see sometimes immigrants who come to this country, you know, they already have the mindset that they have to own their own business, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes because we've been, you know, if every generation has been, you know, working for someone else, then sometimes, you know, that's in your mindset and the next generation. And then, you know, and then sometimes people, you know, parents put their fears upon their children and say, oh, no, you better get a good job or you better be this. And, you know, because it's safe.
Right.
But here, this man, you know, who was African-American and Eritrean, you know, he found a way to, you know, make music and live in his neighborhood. But unfortunately, you know, a tragic incident. And I don't think it'll stop. You know, I don't think that what he did, you know, is going to shut down, you know, the ideas that he had. Hopefully it'll resonate with people and then they'll take it to the next level.
That was the marathon, right?
The marathon. Exactly. Who's going to take the next baton? And you know, when you think about, like, you know, Tupac and all in that generation, they were talking about it, but then here's Nipsey, who was doing it, you know. But there were also, you know, I mean, like I said, Ray Charles, he was doing it.
Yeah, on your
he was
own,
doing it on yeah. his own, you yeah. know, and blind, you know. Yeah.
can I read something to you that a friend of mine who was a filmmaker like you texted to me the other day. We were talking about building community, whether you should stay or leave, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, do you leave the hood you came up in? Because there's also this conversation. And I think, you know, to pause that, I think that, you know, my mission, everything, I relate almost everything to food or the chef business. And, you know, it's my mission to own my own, to own right. everything. And not, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, I can't collaborate or I can't go be an employee for someone. But at the end of the day, whatever my lyrics are, whatever my art is, I want to own it. I want to be in control of where it goes. So we were talking about how can you do that from home, you know, from the hood, or do you have to move away? Yada, yada, because there's a lot of people saying, you know, he shouldn't have stayed there or shouldn't have physically been there. But he says, the problem with our culture is we came here. So that here is post-slavery, the era of Reconstruction and the birth of Black business districts and Black colleges. We came here in the spirit of communalism and got lost in the sauce of commercialism.
Absolutely. So,
how do you feel about that statement?
I mean, absolutely. You know, like I said, I grew up in Chicago. My dad's side of the family is from New Orleans, so I spent my summers here. And community, the community restaurant was the, you know, the church, from the church to the community restaurant, whatever that restaurant was the center of a community. You know, when I look at Dookie Chase restaurant in New Orleans, I mean, that is, you know, a meeting spot for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. And now, you know, in New Orleans, for the younger generation, it's Morrow's, you know. And then when you look in Chicago, you know, on the south side of Chicago, I mean, it was Gladys's and Isola's, you know, and the women that ran those restaurants, you know, they were part mother, grandmother, healer, you know, problem solver to the entire community, you know. Right. So to say that, you know, we haven't we have to go back. We were always there. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just, we need to remind ourselves, you know, that we need to be there, you know? And sometimes it's hard to make that decision, you know, and I'm sure it was hard for people like Nipsey, you know, and, to make decision. And if I'm not mistaken, he had a Creole restaurant, if I'm not mistaken, in Los Angeles and, you know, yeah. And Los Angeles has a strong, you know, Los Angeles and Chicago. I mean, that's where a lot of Afro Creoles from Louisiana moved to.
Right.
Open up Creole restaurants, and there's Creole restaurants in Los Angeles, and there were plenty in Chicago at one time. So, you know, but we have to deal with trauma in our communities. We have to deal with black on black violence. You know.
Yeah.
Mental health. It's a lot that we have to deal with, because when we have people who invest in the community, we need to make sure they're supported and protected at all costs. Yeah. You know?
Absolutely. You speak about, you're just talking about some very strong, formidable pioneers and black women. Why, where do you think the state of, how do I set this up? I asked this in my last interview, but black women are underrepresented in the food world, my words.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you put that up against what they started.
Right.
Right. What they built, you know, in this country as it relates to anything, but we're talking food, and then right. how they're represented in the restaurant and food industry. They're, you know, very, very small numbers as it relates to their representation. Where, how do you think that happened? And if you don't agree with that, then please, you know, like, where is the state of
it's a lot of reasons. You know, part our own, you know, our own mistakes, and also, you know, mainstream culture and media. You know, when you look at restaurants, you know, so food restaurants across the country, a lot of them have closed because the next generation didn't take the baton, you know. Next generation was sometimes, you know, sent to medical school or et cetera. And there was nobody, you know, in the family that was told, hey, you're going to be the one to hold this restaurant down, you know? And, you know, that's problematic, you know, because when you look at generational wealth, it's usually from businesses that have been passed down from generation to generation, you know, and then they just continue to build upon the family brand and the family name. And, you know, it was a push to, you know, after integration, you know, wanted to see what was out there, you mm-hmm. know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, also fast food, you know, and you know, and we do have, there were fast food, but also opened up a lot of opportunities for women and African-American entrepreneurs to own franchises, you know, and that was a first, and that created jobs and, you know, it created some millionaires, you know, but, you know, when you look at today, you know, and I look at Mashama Bailey and, you know, and other young, you know, black female chefs, I think we are reclaiming it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that is, you know, especially when I looked at Mashama's documentary, you know, on Netflix. Yeah. We're reclaiming it because we have to be honest. A lot of us let it go, you know?
We did. I mean, I'm not, you know, a woman, obviously, but I feel like as a culture,
we did.
It was something we stepped away from, like, you know, and not to anybody's fault, but it didn't seem as Now we see the importance of it, but it didn't seem as hot or, you know, enticing.
But I mean, it was also, you know, go back to the trauma. It was, you know, our grandparents didn't want us working in kitchens. They knew what that work was.
Right.
You know, it was meaning work. You know, it was low wages. You know, we were the majority of the labor, and it was hard labor. You know, yeah. From servers and, you know, Pullman porters. It was humiliating work, you know. So, of course, they wouldn't want the next generation to deal with, you know, the trauma that they dealt with.
Yeah, yeah. But we're reclaiming it back, and we have a lot of so much great food work that's going on.
So many
great books coming out. Restaurants, films. You're an author.
Yes.
Filmmaker, historian. What is something about you that people don't know or wouldn't guess? Little known fact about Zella Palmer, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know. That I love to travel. I mean, I think I put that out there. I speak Spanish fluently.
I think we know that from what.
Oh, okay. What else?
Putting the pressure on.
What I'm trying to think. What is it? What do I love? I'm obsessed with. I don't know. Just gardening. I'm really obsessed with gardening. I mean,
gardening. Okay.
Yes, gardening. You know, I'm trying to teach myself how to grow food. My grandmother, who I never met, was from Holly Springs, Mississippi. And my dad told me stories about how she would grow food in Chicago, and mm-hmm. she would preserve and, you know, all this stuff. And I've been really going on this kind of ancestral journey. And part of that is me going to North Carolina from my mother's side of the family. I'm going to my first Lumbee powwow. Which I'm super, super excited about. And to actually visit where my people were enslaved in North Carolina. And I was named after my great-grandmother, who was named Zella Locklear, and she was a Lumbee Indian. So I'm excited to, you know, kind of reclaim that culture again. You know, I always knew my New Orleans side, you know, but I never knew any about my North Carolina side. So I'm excited to go and see what that is about. And I have some chefs down there are, you know, have invited me and welcomed me in, and I appreciate that and looking forward to meeting with them and just learning as much as I can about North Carolina food ways and just Lumbee culture. I'm excited to have a collard sandwich.
A collard sandwich.
Yes, a collard sandwich with some fatback on it. I've been researching. Yeah.
Ooh.
So. I know, I'm excited. And, you know, just even just have some Lumbee earrings and just see what, you know, just feel their spirits and the past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel a fortune. I feel very blessed.
Yes.
To be able to do that. And then, you know, and that's really what I'm moving towards mm-hmm. is learning how to grow food so I can teach other students as well, you know.
I have to tell you, if I can be all the way real with you and the audience, whoever's listening, sometimes as a black man, I know, like my sister is, she's the historian of our family, my mm-hmm. Nisa, my sister Nisa. And my mother is, and I have an aunt, is like, so you have these different people within the family that just know everything about our family and about black history and black culture. And in certain points of my life where I get around certain people, and there's almost a feeling of, or there has been, right now I'm okay. But in the past, there's been a feeling of, like, you know, inadequacy. Like, I don't know enough. I don't know, like, or if I don't have, or if I think I don't have the roots that you have, or if I don't know mm-hmm. about my actual roots, then, you know, there's almost a, you know, this internal, like, pushing away from that, or, you know, unworthiness as it relates to, like, black culture. And
honey, I think, get it.
So what do you do? Like, because we all have, I don't care whether you know, where you're from, you got something that you were from, right? But, you know, how do you start either on that path, or what would your advice be to someone who feels that way? You know?
I think we have to stop shaming each other because we don't know each other's past. Right. You know, I see that sometimes, you know, I mean, you know, you're not from New Orleans, so you wouldn't know, but you know, it's common to want to know what's your last name, you know, because sometimes you can determine how many years does your family go back, you know, because then I know someone that, you know, and I always tell people when they ask me, you know, my people were not free people of color. They were not gens de color libre. You know, they were probably not considered Creole. You know, they were part of the domestic slave trade, you know, but they also added their sweat, their blood, their tears, and their death to this city since the 19th century, mm-hmm. you know. And sometimes, you know, there's a shaming of people if they don't, you know, I want everyone to try to find as much as they possibly can, but still, you know, honoring yourself that you survived,
yeah.
you know, that you are here. That is a testament in itself. Cause you know how many people aren't here,
mm-hmm.
you know, you know, and you create your own stories. I mean, some of my students always come up to me and, you know, after they visit the Whitney Plantation or, you know, we go to some type of culture exchange or trip, all of a sudden their interest is piqued. And the best thing I always tell them is to go sit down with the oldest person in your family and ask them questions, you know, and record them.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can start now and creating these stories and these documents and oral interviews so that for the next generation, they won't have to ponder who they are, you know? And Dr. Conyers, you know, Howard always says, you know, so much of our history and our traditions and our stories are taken to the grave. This generation, our generation, we should be the last ones to take anything to our grave. We have to pass it down to the next generation. And that is really my life's passion and the work mm-hmm. that we do, you know, and any partners or sponsors or, you know, any institutions that we have that partner with us is to preserve those traditions and those legacies and those oral, you know, interviews and documents. And, you know, I think about God, what if we wouldn't have the WPA narratives? We would never know what had happened, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what do we do now? The best thing we do, you know, if you don't know, if you can't trace back, that's okay. Forgive yourself. You don't have to forgive yourself. Just, you know, keep it pushing and you're here. That is a blessing, you know? That is, when you think about all this, you know, our history and understanding, you know, our place in this world and the things that we went through, and to know that you are here alive in 2019, wow, yeah. That's incredible.
And that, you just know. Hearing you say that, you know, because I'm going to dumb it down, you know a lot, right, about history and culture. And to hear you say that, someone like you say that, feels good, quite frankly. It really feels good because you're talking about forgiveness and acceptance and like surrender to the now. And then, okay, that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here. I'm good. All right. So, you know, your existence is important. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you for asking that question because, you know, I hope that, you know, just takes a weight off of everyone has their own journey. I was blessed enough to have, you know, my mother and my grandmother. Mm-hmm. They were the, you know, they always kind of sat down on the rocking chair and told our family stories, you know, but there's so many missing pieces to our family, you know, stories. And, you know, I'm trying to put it together as, you know, a curator and a historian to put it all together so that I can write it down for my children and their children. Because, you know, if it's not there, then, you know, it's just going to be gone forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And with us, it's kind of no excuse. It's like Kevin Lyles was talking about how hard it was. Kevin Lyles, like a music executive, how hard it was back in the 80s to get, or even early 90s, to get your demo tape in front of a, you know, someone.
Exactly.
To record a demo tape and then get it in front of someone. Like, you had to risk your, you know, your physical safety a lot of times because you get hurt. And he was just like, to the generation right now, you got a computer in your pocket. Like, you got YouTube, SoundCloud, all this stuff. There's no excuse that you don't have content with this whole thing. There's no excuse.
Listen. I had two distant cousins that reached out to me within the past year, you know, that found our family and literally, like, shared so much knowledge about our family that my mouth just dropped, right. You know? So, you know, there, it's bringing people together. And when it's used for good, it can bring people together.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it most certainly can. One more thing before I get to the lightning round of on the fly. What was your moment of your rock bottom moment where you didn't know if you know, you wanted to do this, if you wanted to carry on? Have you had any that stuck out?
I mean, of course, you know, I was divorced mom, you know, and, you know, a lot of things that happened. And then, you know, you just kind of like, okay, question yourself, you know, should I follow my passion or should I just get a regular job, you know? And, you know, there at the time, there was no, you know, per se field. I mean, food studies was just starting to take off, you know? And I remember sometimes even I had some professors that would say, oh no, why don't you just, you know, take an internship at, you know, a reputable museum, or not a reputable museum, but, you know, kind of go in the path where everyone else was going, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just followed it's funny, but you know, there's a saying in Cuba that, you know, that in a Western sense, they tell you to, you know, that they're your intuitions. Right. Mm-hmm. But in, African indigenous religions, those aren't your intuitions. Those are your ancestors telling you, no, go this way, mm-hmm. you know? And so I just listened to that, you know, I always loved history. I always loved food. I just didn't know how to merge it all together, you know, and I'm excited that, you know, the next generation won't have to figure it out. They'll just be there for them and an actual curriculum and, you know, a body of tons of, you know, research and books that they can actually read, you know, that can help them in their journey. But I just kept on going. You know,
why? What was your why? Why did you keep going?
Just listening to my ancestors.
Yeah.
You know, just period, point blank. Even those, you know, who told me sometimes no, or, you know, even family members who said, what are you doing? You know, trekking all these, going all over the place. You got kids and, you know, you a mom. Like, what are you doing? You know, and now it makes sense to them. Now they all like, I wish I would have.
Yes.
You know, that's how it is. That's how it is, you know. And I just remained true to myself and just listened, you know, to the inner ancestor in me. And I kept it pushing.
Now you're talking my language. How did you, not to go too spiritual, not that I don't mind, but I don't, you know, how were you able to hear that voice? I find often there's so much noise in my life, and that voice has always been there. The more still I get, it's always been there.
Absolutely.
But now I'm in tune to a point where I can hear it. Like, I literally can hear that, whatever I label it as, intuition, ancestors, source energy, God, I can hear it. And how did you get to be it? Was there ever a time where it was cloudy, you didn't know who was speaking to you or what was speaking to you?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like I said, you know, I feel that there's also a shift or paradigm shift that's happening just with human beings in general, where we're much more spiritually conscious of things, you know, than I think we used to be, where it's okay. We don't have to punish and beat ourselves up for, you know, being attending to self.
Yes.
You know, and for quite some time, you know, in the church, you know, in any religions, you know, because the Bible doesn't say anything, it's people who put, you know, dogma and regimens on people, on you have to be this way, you have to do this, you know, and then you wonder why some people are rebellious towards that. And then when they're rebellious, then you're like, oh, you know, they're not supposed to be this person, that person. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
But for me, it was also like attracting and changing my frequency and attracting like-minded people and my tribe, what I consider my tribe, and going through, you know, some metamorphoses of my own that I needed to go through. Right. Yeah. And eventually when I attracted my tribe and just, you know, being here in New Orleans, which can either be a healing place for some or a place where they lose themselves. Right.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, I had to go through many processes, and eventually, I'm at the place of healing, you know, mm-hmm. and understand and learning meditation, learning yoga, being quiet, you know, meditation is key. I can't express that, you know, enough. And then, you know, the negative inner voice needs to be, you know, canceled out with something positive.
Yeah,
you know, and you have to watch what you speak into existence, mm-hmm. you know, and those are things that I had to learn through time from other people who came into my life who taught me, you know, yes. and I shared it, you know, I share it now with my children. When I hear them, you know, saying something that they shouldn't, or my daughter, or, you know, anybody saying anything around me, I was like, okay, let's change the conversation.
That's
now,
right.
What do you really want to say? You know,
that's right.
And that's the life path. And I'm appreciative to those who taught me, who took the time and saw me, you know, sometimes when I was really down, you know, and really taught me how to change the frequency, you know, and to mm-hmm. control my thoughts. And, you know, not saying that you ignore what you know, anything that might be bad that is happening, but that you not dwell in it.
Absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Because you also have power.
Yeah. We are put here, we're magnificent creators. I believe that. And we're put here to have fun. And once I realized how powerful I am.
Just look at that word, I am.
It's the two most powerful words, you know, if not. What comes after that is truth. And once I realized that I am the creator of my life, and when I would manifest things in a very specific way, and I became conscious of, I just manifested that, it really, it's not even walking around like, things that are uncomfortable or that we don't like. It's not walking around like those don't exist. It's about
right.
What am I going to create? So I can be aware of those things, but what comes after that, I am, it is. Les Brown says, everybody is
my creator. Daughter loves Les Brown. She's always talking about him.
That's my guy. Everybody creates their own world, but only the successful want to admit it.
Right.
So, thank you for sharing that. Let me move you on into the lightning round. I call it on the fly. You know food. I guess you know restaurants. You know what on the fly means.
Okay. Tell me, what's on the fly mean? So what
on the fly? So if we're in the kitchen and, you know, somebody dropped a plate of wings or something, and we need another, you know, you yell back to the fry cook, I need another order of wings on the fly. That means give it to me wings, give it to me quickly. So.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about now. Yeah. I thought it was something else. I'm like, oh, I'm not hip to this. What is that?
Yeah, on the fly. So I ask you the question, you give me the first answer that comes to mind. Cool?
Got it.
All right, biggest roadblock in your path?
Biggest roadblock in my path? Nothing.
You say nothing?
Mm-mm. I manifest that everything is working out for us and everything is working out for my students.
I love that.
There are no roadblocks.
I'm going to sit with that for, okay. I had to let that marinate for a minute. All right. Greatest rapper of all time.
See, that's a trick question. I don't have a greatest rapper of all time, but I do have a rapper that I'm listening to in the moment. It's definitely Nipsey Hussle. I'm really resonating and really vibing with a lot of his lyrics and what he stood for.
Yeah, yeah.
I have many favorite rappers. So, you know, I'm a big hip hop head. Huge.
Yeah.
Yes. Ta.
We're going to have to do it. I'm working on a project right now with hip hop and food. So
I love it. I love it. Yeah. I love it. I love it. Awesome. I mean, I love Tribe. Right now, you know, I'm even respecting these young cats, you know.
Yeah.
And even, you know, little ones who might be a little ratchet, you know, but I like NBA Youngboy. He's from Louisiana, you know. How could I not love him? You know, and he's number one on YouTube, and you got to give respect for that. I love Kevin Gates. You know, it's a lot of them that I out there that I, you know, resonate with, and I love Rhapsody. You know, as a female MC, I mean, she's one of
Rhapsody's
my
bad. She's
Rhapsody's bad. Yeah, Rhapsody's bad. So I have I like all different rappers for different reasons.
I love that. Fill in the blank. Without blank, I wouldn't be successful.
Without my parents, I wouldn't be successful.
Beautiful. Finish this sentence. The restaurant industry needs
more people of color, more inclusivity.
More inclusivity, more people of color. Mm-hmm. And lastly, recommend a book and share why.
Let me look it up right quick. The one that I really like is Isabel Allende. She's one of my favorite authors. Her book Island Beneath the Sea is one of my favorite books of all times, and it's about the Haitian Revolution and some exiles who came to New Orleans, and this beautiful, horrific, tragic, amazing love story, written from the point of view of Haitian exiles who came to New Orleans in the 18th and 19th century. So it's a phenomenal book. And then I also really appreciate, she has a cookbook that I really adore. Two of my favorite cookbooks are obviously by Vertimae Grazer, the Vibration Cooking.
Yes.
And then Isabel Allende's book, and it's about, let me pull it up right quick. The name of it is on the tip of my tongue. I'm Googling right now. Aphrodite, A Memoir of the Senses. That's one of my favorite
cookbooks. A Memoir of the Senses?
Yes. It's all about, you know, how food is pleasure and, you know, what that means in the love and relationships and, you know, femininity and divinity. It's a fabulous book. And then Vibration Cooking, I mean, the introduction to Vertimae's book always, you know, just engulfs me into her world, because it is about vibration cooking. It's what vibes you put into that food, you know.
Absolutely.
It's all about the frequency. It's all about the vibes, you know. And if you, whatever you, I mean, there's, you know, the famous Japanese scientist. I used to do that experiment with my students all the time, the water experiment, or the rice experiment, I'm sorry. And we'd have three, you know, cups of rice. I've been doing this like every semester, but we have three cups of rice, and we'll speak into each cup of rice. And one cup of rice, you say something positive. In another cup of rice, you say negative words. And in the other cup of rice, you don't say anything at all, you know. And after about 3 weeks, the rice changes. And it was this Japanese scientist who, you know, would play music to ice crystals and things. They would create these patterns. And depending on what music was being played, you know, would determine the pattern that would come from, you know, this music.
Right.
And his argument was, you know, that human beings are made up mostly of water, so it matters what we say to each other, you know. And he, you know, and when I started doing the rice experiments, the positive rice, the negative rice turned black and molded and green and stink and all of this other stuff, right? The positive rice turned pink every time. I mean, I've done this experiment so many times that it turned pink.
Wow.
And smelled like flowers.
Wow. Yeah. This is cooked raw rice?
This is cooked rice. This is cooked rice. Now, just imagine that the rice has absorbed the water just like a human being,
I guess.
So then the last rice, the one that's left alone, they got no love, no affection, nothing, is the one that's most molded. And when you think about that, you know, think about what happens with impoverished communities, with, you know, people who get no love, you know, they're the ones that sometimes are hurting the most, you know. And it's deep.
That is very deep. And it makes total sense. You blew my mind, but when I just think of everything is energy. It's all energy. And we are water.
It is.
We are such see it, hear it, touch it, taste it, smell it, people that it takes rice or it takes ice for some of us to understand that.
Absolutely.
That should be like a required side. That's the science experiment that should be in all.
Right. You
know, talk about compassion and loving. We should have that at every level.
Right.
Yeah. That's good that you do that. That's beautiful. I want to come take your class. I'm signing up. Yeah.
those are my top two favorite right now. You know, and I just, Vertimae book, when I, you know, just the title, I was like, wow. You know, when I first read that decades ago, I was just like, wow. She's bad. Vibration cooking, like what? You know, I mean, the Rastas have been talking about that for a long time, but, you know, to hear it from her and, you know, just, you don't need to measure anything. It comes from vibrations. I mean, that's a whole field of study that should come from that. You know, when you think about our ancestors, you know, they worked on vibration. They worked on frequency, you know. And then Aphrodite, Isabel Allende, I'm a phenomenal writer. And, you know, and she has compiled recipes and stories. In this book, she was turning 50 and just that pivotal moment in her life. And looking back at all the lovers she's had and how food was essential to love, you know. And Aphrodite and all these goddesses and all these stories, you know, it's a good book.
You'll have to check it out, and I'll link to all of that in the show notes for anybody who wants to pick those up. How's your library is pretty dope, I imagine.
Yeah, I'm you know, I collect a lot of books. I'm starting to turn into my parents. You know, it's funny because walking in my parents' house is like, you know, just books everywhere, and they just always shopping for books. So I was like, geez, you know, when you get older, you like, you really do turn into your parents.
Yes, indeed. good thing and oh my God thing at the same time.
Right.
I was reading that Oprah said that she can't physically throw a book away. She's tried and she can't do that. She can give
it. I can't do it either.
Throw it away. Yeah.
I can't do it either. And, you know, I have so many on my waiting list on Amazon. It's a shame.
I know. I was looking at my wish list the other day, and I'm like, come on, man. You got to get through this. It'll take some
time. I know.
I got a Marie Kondo my wish list.
Right. Exactly.
It has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Do you have some parting words of wisdom for the audience?
Volunteer, whatever you want to do. You know, for our students and the community, we would love to have you. And then you can find me My Instagram is Maison, M-A-I-S-O-N, Zella. That's it.
Beautiful. It has been an honor. Great to have you on the show. I look forward to seeing all the wonderful things that are coming from you and your program and all that you do, more films on the way, and more writings and all the love and color that's coming out of your environment, if you will.
Hey, that's what I'm talking about. I received that.
Beautiful.
I'm Rock Harper, and you've been listening to the Chef Rock Experiment, the podcast. You can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you've made it this far, take a moment to head on over to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another episode of the Chef Rock Experiment, TCRX. Until then, thank you for listening.